So this is my final lecture for this class, at least for now, until you tell me that you need another one or whatever. I want to talk just a bit about the Quebec student movement in 2012, 2014. And I'll reference the student movements in Puerto Rico and Chile in years since then. So this is all very recent stuff. And it's designed to show you much more is possible in the university, from the university, around the university, between the university and larger movements than you probably thought was possible. Much more is possible than appears to be possible. And let's remember that there does exist such a thing as ideology in our world, and dominant ideology, that is the ideas of the people in power, which are hegemonic with respect to most of us. They dominate us. And the function of this dominant ideology is always to make it look like what you've got right now exhausts the possibilities. That's all there is, right? So the purpose of a class like this one is to try and challenge that dominant ideology and say, actually, much more is possible than is presently actual. And if you look around historically and globally, you can see that. And this is, I think, one of the reasons that American schooling generally prevents us from looking around historically and globally, such that when we travel internationally, all of a sudden we kind of look like idiots because there's a lot of basic stuff about the world that we don't know. It's not your individual fault. It's the fault of our institutions. But the institutions operate as they do because they serve particular interests. Now, I mean, that's a biased position, right? Or it's a position that takes a side. And I guess one of the things I'd like to try to convince you of is that you really don't have a choice about taking a side. A bunch of our pedagogues have said that, right? Like, there's no such thing as neutrality. Not really. Neutrality is a cop-out, which allows you to pretend that you're not doing anything, while in fact you're taking the side of the dominant class and the dominant way of doing things. It's allowing yourself to go along with the crowd thoughtlessly and pretending that it's a virtue, or really it's a form of weakness. Right, so we need to challenge dominant ideologies. We need to challenge the ideas of the oppressors. We need to open up this space of possibility. And so we're finishing this class by looking at like real powerful movements coming out of and being centered in universities. Now, for the character of these movements on the whole, I just will refer you to the videos that I've listed as required for this. Part of the class. These are through Submedia again. I think Submedia has such good stuff. And, you know, if I were you, I would go and watch as many of those like trouble videos as possible. Such quality stuff that you won't see anywhere else. But like, you know, the same as day one, I guess I'll again acknowledge that, you know, in the kind of bracketing presentation, like the narrator that shows up at the beginning and stuff, there's like this anarchist aesthetic going on, which, you know, probably not everybody is going to vibe with. And let me just say the same thing I did before, which is that, yeah, that's like agitational. Yeah, that's non-neutral. Yeah, you might not like it because it challenges some things that you do like. Or you might see that, you know, there's an antagonism towards state authority and a negative portrayal of the forces of law and order. I tend to think that those forces of law and order, you always have to ask, well, like, what order? You know? And if they're keeping peace, like, well, what is it exactly that's passing as peace? Because police are blowing people away every day. But anyway, the main thing I'd say is like, okay, you know, just try to put on hold whatever judgments you've got about the way that this stuff is framed and just look at the content. And the content is like, it's anarchist too. Like the Montreal, the Quebec student movement, those organizers are anarchist, and the model of democratic organization itself is anarchist, because anarchism doesn't just mean breaking stuff and tearing stuff down. That's the negative image that the dominant ideology gives you about anarchism. Anarchism is really about radical democracy, self-determination, equality, and refusal of submission. And that's what's going on with that agitation too. They're trying to act on your sensibilities to get you to feel a little bit anti-authoritarian too. And if you want to have a society that is not, you know, fascist and dictatorial and run for the benefit of a few Elon Musks while everybody else suffers and the planet gets trashed, we certainly need to produce through education, in or outside of schools, some kind of attitude of defiance towards authority. So anyway, if it bugs you, I apologize. It's not there to bug you or to antagonize you, but just look at like these student movements. So what's going on with them, I'm not going to say a whole lot more, but I can add some stuff that comes from another Henri Giroux text, or rather the end of a book that we looked at also towards the beginning of this class, the one that's called Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education. Giroux writes a whole chapter about the Quebec movement. So I called this secondary reading for our class, but I just wanted to glance over a few of the things that he tells us that might not be there explicitly in the video and just reaffirm what they have to do with our class on the whole. And then maybe if I think of something, I'll say some like concluding remarks and we'll call this the end of the class. So what Giroux documents as happening in the Quebec student movement, this is 2012, is that, well, maybe we should give a little bit of background. There are these student organizations called Classe and Assé. Classe is the more radical anarchist one, which pre-exists this movement by decades, right? So, you know, in general, if you want to think about social change, you have to think about establishing the preconditions of social change. What kinds of organizations? What kinds of activism? What kind of institutions? What kind of practices? And these practices are really important because they look a lot like the Zapatista ones. The practices are about assemblies and small groups, organizing small groups and assemblies, getting people together on a non-institutional basis. Now, if you think back to SDS, remember SDS recommended what they called student syndicalism. That is movement on the part of students in order to advance their interests that takes the form of a student union. And you might think, well, but we already have a student union, so we're all covered. But SDS said, well, don't trust the existing student union because it's totally co-opted and neutralized from the get-go. It doesn't have any power. What you need to do is form your own student union. You need to form your own assembly. And you can see like images of these real large-scale assemblies happening in the Quebec movement. That didn't just come out of nowhere, and it wasn't just invented in the course of this particular student strike. It pre-existed, right? They were working on the form of democratic organization, grassroots democratic organization, for decades before this. I really want to emphasize that the model of organizing here, it's the most important thing. I guess what I want to say about it is that, you know, in all these movements, the Puerto Rico and Chile movements as well, I think like probably, you know, they have a lot to do with arguing about schooling, who gets access to schooling, what is the cost of schooling, who can afford schooling. And these are really important things because it really is true that when you get those degrees, then you get certain jobs that you won't get without them, right? Like that's true. And I'm you know, and this class is not meant to make you drop out of the university. It'd be really cool if it made you think about organizing at the university. But we need those degrees, right? Like because we need those jobs, because we need that security, because we need to live, because we have kids that we love and we want to be able to protect and all that, right? So the goals of these movements, they all have a lot to do with things that we've heard over and over and over and that are real issues at Dominguez Hills too. Tuition and fees and student debt. You know, like this is like a common situation of students globally in this neoliberal world. So the movement is really aimed at like reform of the school, not replacement of the school. And it's aimed at like, therefore, changing schooling and not necessarily replacing schooling with education. But my point is that the process of organization of the student unions and of the small groups, that and those meetings of those small groups in particular, that has the character of education that we've been looking at from our liberation pedagogues forward, or from our progressive education forward. Like, so you're getting together in small groups. You're sitting in a circle. There's no authority in these groups. There's nobody who's in charge of everybody else. The job is to inform ourselves and one another about our real situation. So we're just looking at the situation of schooling and talking about it, looking at the relationship between schooling and communities and talking about it, looking at how there are some people who can afford these tuition hikes and other people can't. It's a tuition hike that started the Quebec strike in 2012, and that strike ended up involving over 500,000 people and shutting Montreal down and being the largest act of civil disobedience, because protest had been made illegal. The largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history starts with this protest against a tuition hike, right? But what were the discussions happening in these small groups? Like, hey, look, like the surrounding communities here, they're not equal. The class positions are not equal. And so when the tuition goes up, it doesn't impact people equally. Some people can afford it. It's not a big deal. Some people won't be able to go to college anymore, right? So in these small groups, education in a quite a profound form is happening. Another thing I would draw attention to, and this is true actually for Puerto Rico, for Chile, and for Quebec, they're all following models of organization which are kind of like, you know, council based, which are based on very small groups which are autonomous, which can make their own choices, and then which also have the capacity to meet together and to choreograph and synchronize their actions through larger scale assemblies. Right, that's the student union. And all that stuff is controlled from the bottom up by students. It's not institution affiliated. It's not overseen by some faculty advisors, and its powers are not limited by some administrators, right? Like, they are making decisions about what they themselves will directly do. They have already taken power, right? This is a power movement. The other thing I wanted to draw your attention to, which seems so important to me, you know, through this class, I've often come back to the fact that I am a lecturer. I'm not a full-time professor. And you can think this is just me grumping. I've been doing this 23 years and I have no future. But I'm in the same situation as 70% of all college teachers. It's even the case, if you go back and read the earlier Giroux, that like full-time faculty are increasingly under attack by neoliberalism too, right? So their capacities to govern are severely constrained. That's true at Dominguez, right? Like, we have the Academic Senate, but like, the faculty doesn't govern through Academic Senate. It talks about its issues and it makes recommendations. The admin governs, period. There's an increasingly authoritarian character to the universities, where even faculty are disempowered, and where faculty are increasingly called on to perform administrative functions. And you know, I see the bottom end of, like, you know, my full-time colleagues are the ones who hire and fire me. And so I find it very difficult to see how we share an interest that can be adequately represented by the same union. But if you see this from the full-timer perspective, they're being called on to manage me, when really what they signed up for was to do research in a particular field that they have an interest in and a capacity for, right? So they're having to do things. And then, like, you know, budgets are always being cut. The number of tenure trackers is always being cut. Tenure itself is always being attacked, right? So faculty in general are under attack by neoliberalism at the same time that students are. And lecturers, even more so. So what I wanted to point out is that in the process of organizing students in Puerto Rico and in Quebec, the groups, the small groups that are getting together, often include both students and teachers, but not in the way where, like, the teacher is in charge of the group. Rather, that they're getting together to talk about the situation from their different perspectives and to plot courses of action, to identify shared interests, to identify possibilities for action and risks of action, and to come to a conclusion together about how to act. And I'm sure that there were also, although I haven't read this, but I'm sure that there were also gatherings of just lecturers, of just faculty, to talk through, okay, this is going down. This is a big thing. They're going to go on strike. They're going to boycott the school to stop this tuition hike where do we stand on this? And a bunch of the more conservative people said, we stand against it. We don't want anything to do with them. But then there were a bunch of people who were in solidarity with the students, and they talked together on their basis, like, okay, here's what we think we can do, and here's what's going to jeopardize our jobs, and here's the degree to which we might be willing to jeopardize our jobs, but here's a degree that some of us can't go because of our kids and all the rest, right? These are the kinds of things. You know, this pattern is basically just organizing stripped down to its essence. You know, organizing a population means making them capable of understanding in the same way and acting together. That's it. How do you do that? By getting people together, by talking to people one-on-one. This is what we do when we organize unions, when we try to get people together for an action. We just go and talk to people, and we see where they're at, and we see if we can find some commonality, and if we can persuade them that maybe action is a good idea. And when you start to get people together in bigger groups, they start to feel their power. They start to be like, oh yeah, well, if we all do it, if we all walk out, what are they going to do? They need our tuition for the institution to run, right? We actually have power. As you start to organize, you start to feel the reality of your power. But it's not just that it was there before and you didn't feel it. It was only potentially there. It wasn't fully there. It wasn't actuated yet. But as you start to get people into groups and to actually have synchronized motions where they show up at the same time or they carry out an action at the same time, you have literally, through organizing, built power, constructed at a social and behavioral level capacities for action. And you can feel that. And it's empowering. It feels really good. Because you might not notice how bad it feels to be passive and bossed and isolated all the time. But when you get those things reversed, you feel different. I can testify to this, that, you know, I've been trying to organize lecturers and students together for going on, I guess, really more like a decade. And I have not had any significant successes. You know, I don't know that I'm a particularly good organizer. I'm kind of split, right? I want to do my music stuff and whatever. So I'm not claiming any grand successes. But what I will say is that through organizing my colleagues, I completely transformed my relationship to the place where I work, right? And to the students who I work with, right? Like that separation between teachers and students, it goes away when you actually talk honestly together and then take an action together. It disappears. You have chosen being people in a shared situation over being the institutional roles that this institution has given you, which are designed to keep you separate and to keep one small portion of us managing the rest of us. Right? Like once you start to organize and to direct your own action to change your situation in ways that you want, now your world is different. So when I show up at work, I know who my enemies are. But I also know that I have allies, and that makes work feel different. That makes school feel different. And when I, like, you know, spend free time talking with students and will support them, or they will support me, or we'll get together and do things, we break down that divide that says that they're students and that I'm faculty and we don't have anything in common. And we start to realize, no, we're just people that have to deal with the same situation, right? Okay, so that's the main thing that I wanted to say, is that the form of organizing that happens in Quebec and Puerto Rico and Chile, which you can see in detail when you go watch the documentary, itself is educational. And itself also, you could say, is a form of, what's the word, prefiguration, of being the change that you want to see in the world, to use Gandhi's language, or of building the seed of the new in the shell of the old, to use the old wobbly IWW language. Like, we can actually take it upon ourselves to construct the relationships and the spaces and the discussions and the education that we want, that we need. We can do it ourselves. And even if it seems like an infinitely long road and like really dangerous, or it's or like fruitless, right? Because we're so focused on the idea of getting the degree to get the job, like you can't survive otherwise. But these are not mutually exclusive. You can still make it through school, but also take part in trying to construct real education, working class education, an education that advances our needs, that makes the people we need to be exist, and the type of people that we need for our society, for defending our society, for defending working class people, regular people who have to work. How do we defend ourselves? We can make those groups. We can make study groups in communities. We can get our friends together, and instead of like going to the bar, instead of watching the game, we can talk about real stuff. We can talk about our wages. We can talk about our class situation. We can talk about our problems with our kids. We can talk about problems in our communities, problems of violence, problems. We can do it ourselves. We can educate ourselves. And what's magnificent to me is that when you start doing that stuff, your whole world changes because the horizon of possibilities changes. We have it in our power to build power by getting together. And this requires that we respect one another, that we are vulnerable with one another, that we see one another, and not just our phones, not just our screens, that we actually look one another in the eye. You know, one of our interesting conversations last semester was about how we're losing like the neurocognitive ability to interact with other faces. And if you've studied, you know, neuroscience at all, you'll know there's a part of the brain that's just about faces. Like, other people are a part of our wiring, and we seem to be losing that sort of stuff. So we have to put in, you know, an effort here. But when we do it, we have immediately improved our world. You know, even if we don't achieve the changes that we can identify and that we then attempt to achieve in the structures that surround us, we can change the world just by changing how we act in it and starting to act in a more communal way and pulling ourselves together. Now, I guess that could wrap up the course right there. I'm remembering, you know, one little detail I wanted to mention about Quebec, and this is what Giroux talks about, that, you know, the institution of school is not separate from the larger political socioeconomic fabric, not at all. It performs a function with respect to it. It is intrinsic to it. If you attack it, they will shoot you, as they did at Tlatelolco Square. The Mexican military shot 400 students thereabouts, right? It's really involved. But like, you can see in these movements that they'll start, like this one started just about tuition and debt, increased fees. At Dominguez, this is always the case. When I like do my one-on-ones and like pull together small groups, which I do as much as I can at Dominguez, when we talk about what are the things that impact everybody, it always comes back to fees and tuition. You know, the Cal States used to be free. They're supposed to be free for you. Where's all that state money go? Where's all that federal money go? It goes to the military, police, and prisons. It's not that there's not enough money. It's that they're put into state repressive forces. And by that means, also into the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex. That is, into one sector of corporate capital. Right? Like, that's what's happening. It's not that it's not possible to have a different world. It's that we just don't have a different world right now. We would have to work on it. Anyway, the point is that if you start in this institution, you're gonna, and you stick with it, you're gonna find yourself pulled into broader issues. And this is what happens in Quebec. This is what happens in Montreal, right? Eventually, the whole city is involved in what started as just a student strike. The student strike leads to larger and larger street demonstrations. The government responds with a serious crackdown. It makes protest illegal, and it systematically attacks these people physically. It doesn't help that you're in Canada, which is supposedly like, you know, softer than the United States or something. It's the same shit. They send the young, thoughtless people with their billy clubs and their guns to beat down whoever is suggesting that the society should be different, and more specifically, anybody who's attacking the social reproductive function of the schooling, they attack them. But this has repercussions. This is not the end of the story. When the broader population sees their kids getting attacked by the police and sees their government outlawing protests, which is, you know, totally valid protest, saying we can't afford this stuff, when you raise this tuition, some people, the poorer people, are going to be made incapable of going through school, and therefore they're being like, your tuition hike is a way of increasing class differences and shutting the door to comfort and respect for a bunch of people, right? They start there. Those are valid complaints. And then when the broader community sees the way that the state responds to them, now the protest spreads. Because, you know, like student debt is an issue of students. But debt and being indebted is a feature of neoliberalism, right? Like prior to the 1970s, most students were not in debt. It was not a regular thing to take on so much debt that like you might not work it off. Like, you know what? I graduated undergraduate in 1996. I'm still paying for my loans from that period. That's kind of insane, right? I mean, how long ago is that? 27 years I've been paying this shit. Because debt is a great thing for banks, right? Like they can make you pay back so much. There's so much revenue to be had there. So student debt actually points you towards the broader phenomenon of social debt, of debt as a mechanism for controlling the working class, or yet another way of exploiting the working class. You know, in the Bible, it's called like, you know, usury or something, right? Like it's immoral to lend people money with high interest rates and then take back more from them just because you can. And notice how it's structural differences that make that predatory relationship possible. It's property, a property structure that makes that predatory relation possible, because some people don't have money and need it, and other people do have money, and they're going to use their property to get more property, right? So you can move from student debt to debt in general. And now you have a movement that is engaging all kinds of people across the entire city, across the entire state, or the entire province in this case, right? So those kinds of explosions are really interesting. And the interactions between what can happen at the school, where we really are thinking about this stuff, where the paradox of education is operating such that even though they're trying to shut down our thinking, we're doing a lot of cognitive stuff, and we might get reflectively aware of like some stuff that's real that we didn't know before. Anyway, look at that motion between the universities and the broader society. And that said, I think I will say you have made it to the end of the course. You know, go check out those videos if you haven't. I find them very provocative. They're large-scale movements that I bet you never heard of before. And you know, why? Why didn't you hear of them before? There's selections going on here, right? There's determination. Somebody's determining the reality that you get to encounter. But who is it, right? And why? What is the basis of their selection? Anyway, so I hope that I have caused you to distinguish between schooling and education, to think about like the problem that if schooling is run from the top down and for the benefit of a few, that like what we would really need from the bottom is maybe something else. You know, I hope maybe you've started to think more broadly about the way that particular institutions like schooling are connected to larger arrangements of power, economic power and political power, and even to big institutions of coercion like prison systems, police systems, the military. And, you know, I hope that you'll let me know what was interesting and positive in this course, according to you, and what was problematic or weak in this course, according to you. I would really like to hear that stuff. Please let me know. Email me. And I always take into account what students say, and I change the next generation of the course. So you'll be doing a favor for future generations if you weigh in on, like, you know, what should I keep? What should I lose? What problems are still fuzzy and which ones are clear? You know, any advice that you have for me, I would really appreciate it. And, you know, have a good whatever comes next.